he's looking for a speech on Wi-Fi, I think.
Oh. I don't know about that.
Where did he go?
Is this what you're talking about? I'm looking for Wi-Fi.
Probably in the...
Welcome, everyone. This is Hope number 6. It is Saturday. I hope it's Saturday. 1400, that means it's time for the keynote. Number 92, apparently redesignated. Michael Hart will be talking in a minute. I have one quick announcement to make. John Erickson, author of Hacking, The Art of Exploitation, will be at the Ham Table at 2 p.m., which is now, signing books. And he'll be there for as long as there are books, so don't be rushing to get there. We are about to hand it over. That's all the announcements I had. Without further ado, number 92.
As long as you only think it's that good after it's over, okay? Everything I'm going to say after this is just bells and whistles. This is the important part. I'll say it again at the end. I'm here to try to help you save the world. You're hackers, and I'm going to ask you to find every ebook in the world that you can get your hands on and send it to us. And if you have trouble finding us, then you're not real hackers. But I'm Hart at pglaf.org, and he's GB Newby at pglaf.org, and a bunch of other things. And PGLAF, in case you need a mnemonic, is Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. That's us. Okay, now, what we want to do is give away as many ebooks to as many people as possible. That's the whole gig, okay? And I'm asking you to help because we have just grown so far out of proportion, it'll drive you crazy. Oh, maybe I do. I'll use left hand. There we go. Then I can talk and point at the same time. This is the major idea. I'm hoping that you can think so far outside the box in making this go that everything we ever did before will look really small. So far, we've given away about 1 1/3 trillion ebooks, and I want to make that look tiny, really, really tiny. So that's the goal. Now, most of you know that there wasn't much in the way of literacy before Johann Gutenberg invented the printing press. In fact, the average book before Gutenberg cost as much as the average family farm. And the literacy rate was probably less than 1%. When somebody wanted information to get out, they put a poster up someplace. And the one person in the village who could read, read it to everybody. That was the general way that things went. All right. In the next 50 years, after the invention of the Gutenberg printing press, more books were printed than in all the previous history of the world. I'm hoping that in the next 50 years, more ebooks will be created than there were ever books in the whole previous history of the world. These are our mission statements. They're pretty simple, pretty straightforward. And the most important part is you. I'm hoping you can help me find all the books that have been hidden away, lost, different sites that went down. If you hunt through alexa.com and find some one of the old backups or anything like that, anybody who has backups, we don't mind. We would rather get a dozen versions of the same book than not get one. So don't worry about sending us stuff that you think we already have. We've created so far about 20,000 ebooks on our own. And we've had another 80,000 or so donated to us from over 100 other ebook collections around the world. At this very moment, we're celebrating the 35th anniversary of the very first step in making electronic books, which was this month in 1971. First time I ever heard there was such a thing as the internet. And I said, let's put something on it that won't go away. I wanted to put something on it that would still be there 10 years, 100 years later. And I didn't know I was dyslexic at the time, but I knew that programming was really hard. And it's really hard if you can't tell the difference between a comma and a semicolon. And I had nightmares in Fortran. So I decided rather than try to write some program that would stick around for a while, that I should put something up there that everybody, a general interest idea that everybody would want. And as luck would have it, that 4th of July, on the way back to the computer lab, I stopped for some munchies, and they threw in one of those faux parchment Declaration of Independence copies they handed out back around the bicentennial. And when I dumped all my junk out on the floor, that popped out, and the light bulb went on over my head. Literally, I was just totally lucky. And anybody who ever says they did a project like this and wasn't really lucky, I would be suspicious of them. I could never have done this without a lot of luck and a lot of people helping me, including our PGLAF CEO, Greg Newby. Come on.
That's me.
He does so much of the stuff that I could never do. I'm a seat of the pants kind of guy. I just think up wild ideas and push and try to get the snowball over the edge to where it starts to pile up. That's my strength. Okay. Now, I'm supposed to mention that we're going to be giving away millions of ebooks right now. So people are going to be walking around handing out DVDs, and there are going to be some back at the table. And if you collect both DVDs that we have, you'll have about as many books as the average public library. We also have some DVD images online that we're hoping that people like you will take a bonus round on. We have filled them up two-thirds of the way to 20,000 books and left a blank spot for 10,000 that you choose. We want you to take these, fill in stuff, give them to your friends, have them fill in stuff. We want them to go everywhere, go every place. We'd like to get them from Tierra del Fuego and Australia and back from anywhere that you can find books that may or may not be of interest to anybody. We want to get everything. And so we're handing these out that are, if you put them on a rewritable disk, you can just keep adding on to them, and when you get it filled up to where you think you're going to be pretty much done, please just make me a copy and send it to me or put it someplace where I can download it.
Let me tell you about the one that we're giving out. So we have, I think, enough for everyone who's here. If we don't have enough, you go to gutenberg.org/CD project. There's a form you fill out, and we'll send a free DVD anywhere in the world, postage paid. We are able to afford this because people that get them sometimes give us back $5 or $10 to help us give out a few more. The one that you're getting, we just made for this conference. It's got 17,500 ebooks on it. It is nearly full, this one. It's got a lot of HTML. It's got some audio stuff. It may not be sold, this one. It has copyrighted materials on it that were donated to us. So unlike some of the ones you see resold on eBay because of public domain and stuff like that, this one may not be sold. We consider that to be a good thing. So what it says, though, is give me away. So make copies, get the ISO, email me if you can't find it. I'm going to put the ISO up online later on today. It's about, 4.3 gig. And enjoy it, copy it, pass it on, and share a file, share the whole thing, make your own sub-collection, and get it out there.
Yeah, don't worry about selling it. I mean, you can sell it for enough to pay for the postage or the blank or whatever. Don't worry about that stuff. But it's just not supposed to be retailed out there. The whole idea behind all this is we figure the world is going to be a better place if we just jack up the literacy rate and the education rate. This whole idea is to build things from the bottom up, not from the top down. We don't have any grants. We don't have any major people talking for us. What you see here is what you get. We're it. And there have been five information ages, five technological revolutions that basically turned the whole idea of publishing on its head. Now, I've got a lot. I'm going to run through all these little slides here and then come back and talk to the ones you want to hear about the most. I'm not stuck with giving a pre-prepared speech. I could talk about every one of these topics for the whole time. So if I'm talking about something that's boring, kind of just go like this, and if I'm talking about something you like, yeah, right, I want more of that. We'll just fire through all these. This is my wildest dream here. This is as far as I've dreamed. If we do 10 million public domain books and then get machine translation to put those into 100 different languages, that'll be a billion volume library. If we give them to 1 out of 6 or 1 out of 7 or 1 out of 8 people on the planet, that's a quintillion books. Okay, so what if I'm off by a factor of 1,000? Then I only get to give away a quadrillion books. Okay, that's the goal. We're not waiting for somebody's approval. We're not waiting for Bill Gates or any of those guys to say, hey, you guys are doing great work. All of this has been done with no freaking money. Project Gutenberg has never run through $1 million in its entire 35-year existence. All of it, period. Not counting every dollar I've had and every dollar that's come in and out of Project Gutenberg. All right. All you have to do is do this stuff. Anybody can make an e-book. Anybody. You can sit down and type it in, scan it in. You can snail mail it to us, and we'll scan it for you, and then you can proofread it, or we'll proofread it. We'll do all the copyright research. We'll do everything we can possibly do to help you out. This is what if we get a funny question. This is me way back in the back there with the 20,000 books. Now, some people say that e-books have never made it. They're never going to make it. Nobody's ever going to pay attention to them. This is my counterexample. This is the best-selling book in the last 4 years. And in the acknowledgments page, right there is a list of over a dozen of the most famous libraries in the entire planet. And you'll notice number 3 there kind of sticks out. Okay, we got the Bibliothèque Nationale, we got the Louvre, we got all the famous libraries, but number 3 on the list is Project Gutenberg. Because we have a very wide variety of Bibles and Apocrypha and all sorts of other stuff that you can't get anyplace else. Nobody wants them. Nobody has them. And you can search them all. He did a lot of research on this book. That's the only reason I'm making the point is this kind of library makes it really easy to research Shakespeare, the Bible, the Greek plays, stuff like that. That's what I'm hoping for. That's if we took all those boxes and put them on top of each other. Somebody wanted a one-sided version. All right, this is a graph for people who always said every year that we couldn't do it for one more year. Every single year, there hasn't been a year go by that I haven't got messages from people that says, you can never do it for one more year. People would say, don't worry about Project Gutenberg. They won't possibly stick around for another year. This is how we got to 10,000 books. And this is as accurate as Greg could make it. I have another graph up here that we can get up when I'm playing with the computer at the end that is exactly accurate. This one has proportional spacing. It's very hard to make a graph with proportional spacing. Greg did his best. But it's not quite perfect. But I do have a perfect one for you if you want it. This is the same thing up to 20,000. And with your help, we'll stack another 40,000 on top of that. Okay.
What people should see here is we've been doubling every 18 months or so. So more or less a Moore's Law type of power curve, doubling the number of e-books every 18 months or so. And that's achieved in a number of ways. Most of it is technological advancement combined with more volunteers. And there's a lot of ways to volunteer. Distributed proofreaders is the easiest place to get started. pgdp.net, distributed proofreaders.
Every year, though, we just barely make it. I do have to warn you about that. If you're on my mailing list, you will get notes when we're just coming up to it, and people send me back, stop jumping up and down and yelling and screaming. I know you're only 1% away from the goal, but that's the kind of person I am. Don't really want to get into an argument about what an e-book is right now, but if you guys are more interested in it, we'll come back to it. I already mentioned about how anybody can make an e-book. These are a couple little things that Greg and I have been talking about. That relate to some of the conversations we heard here already. We don't care who gets the credit for the e-books. You send us an e-book, we'll put your name on it, your email address, your URL, whatever you like. We'll give you 2 lines to put anything you want. If you've got a .com site and you want to put the URL on there, that's just fine with me. Everybody should get credit for what they do. I certainly don't need the credit. You guys should have the credit. And by the way, for some odd reason, having Project Gutenberg on your resume seems to help. Heaven only knows they would never hire me, but they tend to hire the people that work for me. And of course, that was by Anonymous, one of our favorite sources.
Got a lot of books by him, actually.
We do. We have a lot of books by Anonymous. This is something that Vint Cerf said when he came to the 10th anniversary of browsers. And I should mention, since we're talking about credit and stuff, that Mark Andreessen got no credit. He was never mentioned at the 10th anniversary of browsers. Mosaic was never mentioned. Netscape was never mentioned. It was one of those big political to-dos where all the guys in fancy suits that were wearing my salary, they all got up there and talked about browsers without ever giving credit to him. And that's the way it goes. People are always telling me I can't do this. And I just got to say, okay, just leave me alone. I'll succeed or fail, and you can watch. There's a much nicer way of saying the same thing. But it works very well. If you put one book in our collection, tomorrow there's a billion possible people who could download it. It will never get deleted. Not one of our books has ever been deleted. We did take out Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech without being asked. I don't know how many of you kept up with the law, but it got changed and reversed and appealed and all sorts of stuff. And when it was all over, it was declared copyrighted. And we just took it out because we thought it was okay. We left a slot for it. We also have Arthur C. Clarke's permission. We reserved slot 2001 for 2001. But it's not in there. All right, this gets a little heavier light on the same picture. We get a lot of conversations about light and darkness. And there are people who look at what's going on right now and think this is the greatest information age that's ever been. And there are people who look at it and say it's a new dark ages because a smaller percentage of the information is available than ever before since the Gutenberg press. Copyright has become virtually permanent. Now, copyright is not my favorite thing to talk about, but again, this is your guys' show. Whatever you guys ask about, we don't have to wait to the end for questions. When we get to the end and roll back, feel free to interrupt me anywhere and guide this anywhere you like. All right. I'm hoping that everybody will have a bunch of libraries. In fact, I brought a little example.
I bought this less than 100 miles from here
for $5 at a garage sale. I have these in my room in paper, and my floor is 1 inch lower than it was when I put them in there. Okay? If any of you have ever physically seen a century's worth of National Geographic, you know what I'm talking about. They're massive. And this book, of course, if I took them all out and put them in a little folder, there's only 30 CDs in here. Not even DVDs, CDs. And they would fit in a little kid's carrying case that they carry along with their Walkman or whatever. Okay? Let's see. All right.
Are the ads in there too? Are the ads in there too?
Are there ads? The photographs of the pages, so the ads that had, if there was a page that was only an ad, which there were plenty of, I can't tell you whether all of those were in there or not. I thought the ads were kind of enlightening myself. They're very cute, tell a lot about our culture and a lot about the pre-World War I stuff. I'll be glad to talk to you about it afterwards. Now, we have a slight generation gap. I'm getting a little old. But most of you could go into your attic or your basement and find a paperback that said 25 cents on it, whether it was an Agatha Christie or a pre-James Bond or a Perry Mason or stuff like that. My attic, my parents were bookaholics, and my attic was full of those things. And rare were the ones that were 50 cents or 35 cents. They were almost all 25 cents. Those same books at Borders and Barnes & Noble and stuff today are closing in on $10. Again, I don't want to dwell too much on negative stuff, but I can tell you all the changes that have gone through with paper publications and prices and price fixing and stuff like that. But if you imagine that a gallon of gas today costs as much as a paperback today, I want you to think about the media frenzy that would be going on. They're going nuts with $3 a gallon. What the heck would they be doing if we were pushing $10 a gallon? But I've never in my life heard one story about the price of books, which has gone up way faster than the price of gas. Whoa. Maybe we'll come back and talk about that. Okay. Here's the five information ages. You notice one of them was very, very short. The United States issued a patent in 1830 for the first high-speed steam-powered printing press, and a copyright law came out to stifle the thing in 1831. Now, this was no accident. The United States copyright started in 1790 and basically got going pretty well by the turn of the century. So those books had a maximum copyright span of about 28 and a half years. Okay, so they just started expiring. So this guy gets an idea, hey, we could build all these reprint houses and fill up boxcars on the railroad and ship off all these books. Became an awfully lot easier to print books. Pretty much to the same order of magnitude as how much easier it got when Gutenberg came along. Now, the original copyright was created specifically to stifle the Gutenberg press. I don't want to go into all the politics unless you guys are seriously interested in English history, but I have a whole list of all the monarchs of England that they went through trying to get the law passed, and nobody would go for it. And fire and agriculture and the wheel. I do have, no, I'm not joking. No, I have articles that start with those. You're absolutely right. The first thing I said when they told me we were on the internet was I said, did they send a message like what hath God wrought? And they said, no. And I said, we have to send something. And I haven't got to that part yet, but that's where I typed in the Declaration of Independence and tried to email it to everybody. And if I'd have succeeded, you would have never heard of the Morris worm, but that's another part of the story too. I actually tried to email the Declaration of Independence to all 100 people that were on the internet, which would have killed it. But luckily somebody stopped me and said, let's put a note on what later became CompGen, and we'll just tell them it's there and they can download it. Okay. Yes, there's a, this is, we got 90 minutes here, and you're right, I'm skipping over it like a stone over the water, and I apologize, but any, if you, there are details that everybody's interested in, I'm more than happy to go for them.
Get up to the microphone and just interrupt when you have something to say. Be happy to
I'll repeat the questions too if you don't want to jump up.
Yeah.
So when I grew up, it was the 1909 copyright, and everything could be copyrighted for a maximum of 56 years, 28 with a 28-year renewal. Stuff like Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz and all that stuff, Peter Pan. All the things I grew up with, it was basic idea was, if you saw it in print and you lived to be over 50 years old, you were going to be able to republish it yourself. However, while I was working on a particular edition of Shakespeare for the Gutenberg Project, they extended the copyright law back in 1976 because of the Xerox machine. They also extended in 1909 due to the high-speed electric presses. There's a great story there, and I feel like I really should tell why all this stuff happened. The Sears catalog was a 768-page book, lavishly illustrated, that was the first book owned by millions and millions and millions of people. Because the combination of a bunch of different kinds of technology, including the Transcontinental Railroad, the high-speed printing presses, rural federal delivery, which everybody forgets about, but before then you couldn't mail stuff to people out in the boonies, and everybody lived out in the boonies. So Sears got the really wise idea of mass-producing millions and millions and millions of these things and mailing them to every single person they could find. This upset the publishing industry all to hell. because all of a sudden everybody was aware that you could make a huge book and send it to somebody at less cost than could be recovered if they bought a couple things out of the catalog. This drove everybody absolutely nuts, and copyright was yet extended again to stop the what they called reprint houses. If you go into your used bookstores and you look at stuff that's 100 years old, you'll see a lot of things by publishers that don't exist anymore, but a few that do are Grosset and Dunlap and Collier's and stuff like that, who specialized in reprinting stuff. You got to realize that in 1900, you could print almost anything published more than 25 years before them. 90% of all copyrights had never been renewed. Now, if you want to fight with any of these statistics, you fight with him.
It's still the
case.
Because
he is a PhD of library and information science, knows this stuff better than I do.
And it's still the case. 90% are not renewed. This means, by the way, that we have an opportunity for about a million books that you might think are still under copyright between 1923 and 1963, and yet are actually in the public domain. We started that with our Rule 6, for those of you who have seen the website, for copyright clearance, and this is an awesome opportunity for harvesting. Listen, are these DVDs going around? They are? Okay. If you got a library, you know, maybe you have a child, maybe you know someone young at a school library, 17,000 ebooks is more than you find in the average school library. If you know someone if you know someone that would like to get one of these, take a couple. We have a whole box of them back here. At the end of the talk, we'll take a few boxes with us to the Pentop North area.
I am also very fond of throwing them at people.
Just want to clarify real quick. You did say that there are two of these.
Yeah, there was one we were handing out yesterday that has a different stamp on it.
Because we're seeing a red one and a white one go around. We just want to clarify that.
The 2006 one is the one that should be going around. They should be. I hope they're all stamped. They came from the same volunteer that produces them. It should say 2006 on it. What you probably got when you checked in, depending on when you registered when you showed up for the conference, is the 2003 edition. Those have a lot of overlap, although a number of the things from 2003 have been updated since then. So we do have a whole bunch of both of these. If you take them both, you'll have sort of an older version, newer version, and the older one is primarily plain text. This one has a lot of plain text that are zipped, as well as a lot of HTML. Some of our neat multimedia stuff. I put on the atom bomb explosion. We have Janice Ian doing Society's Child, one of your favorites.
She did it live for us, just for us. It's a totally Project Gutenberg version.
Yeah, very cool. So if you want both, go ahead and take both. We definitely have enough to give away both. But if they're different colors, just because we tend to buy these in bulk and get the cheapest deal, so they might not match. But it should be stamped with 2006 for the one I was mentioning, the most recent one. And as I said, the ISO for that is online someplace, but not really advertised. If you're desperate to get it right away, drop me an email or ask me, and I'll tell you where to get it. But I'll have it uploaded to the Gutenberg.org site over the next couple of days.
And we have several other ones, too.
Does the project have a preferred format for the books that it's in? I mean, as far as readability, I like reading PDFs, but it's a closed format.
The preferred format. We're really committed to formats which are editable, that you can fix, that you can use for derivative works. You can put in your book report, stuff like that. Basically, that means we have a bias towards including plain text, but that doesn't mean we are limited to plain text. These days, probably 80 or 90, 85% of our new books are in HTML plus text. Usually the text is derivative from the HTML, so the HTML is the master. We have just a few, and we're going to be doing this in the future with distributed proofreaders, is XML. So they'll be born as XML using TEI, XLite, DTD, for those of you who care, and convert from XML to just about any viable format. We're going to do text, HTML, maybe a couple others, and store those on our servers and get those out to all our mirrors around the world. And then what we want to do, and we don't have this fully activated yet, and we could use some skilled people for this, is do almost any other reasonable format on the fly. So a PDF on the fly from an XML is cake, right? All you need is a little CPU power to throw at the problem. And all of a sudden, instead of having one PDF file like you get from these for fee sites with ebooks, you say, hey, I want this font, I want this size paper, I want to do left and right margins versus, you know, same margins, and you get your ebook your way, which is something we feel really strongly about. So we have, I think, literally about one PDF-only ebook, and that was this ebook that had 72 languages in it. And it was just impossible. We couldn't even do it with RTF. Otherwise, we really are committed to editable formats. We also go back and fix ebooks to the tune of at least a couple dozen a week, and that's obviously important to have an editable file. You can't really fix a PDF file too easily.
I was wondering if you collect like technical documents and stuff like that, documentation, old manuals.
Yeah, we'll take all of those.
Yeah, tech docs. We'd like to archive them. And I think one thing that we haven't done a lot in the main Gutenberg collection, the Gutenberg.org collection, which is this close to 20,000 that we're doing on the DVD, is we've avoided doing a lot of the technical books because they can be transient, and also there are usually a lot of other people that are doing those these days. What we're doing, and this gets back to the slide you had earlier about the average person before Gutenberg having only one e-library, right? So we're doing collections of collections. And what I'd really like to do is set up a technical ebook collection so that all the people that are doing free documentation licenses, Creative Commons types of licenses, if they'd like to contribute their stuff, we'd like to provide a place for where that can go and be archived. We actually are pretty close collaborators with the Internet Archive and some of these other projects. And just like them, you know, we believe that if it's spinning, if it's online, it's mirrored, it's on disk, it's downloadable, we feel like that's a pretty good place to be. We are concerned about things that are on paper someplace and aren't digital and maybe will just be inaccessible in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. We feel really strongly that, and this gets back to the previous question about text, that the work we do today had better still be usable, valuable, relevant. We don't know how many people are going to use it or for what, but we want to at least make it sure it's still usable and accessible in certainly 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, not just 5 years, 10 years. And if we were going with the format of the day 20 years ago, we'd have formats that we couldn't read today. And in fact, we do have one. We have one of the Shakespeare's in the folio format.
The .info from format.
Yeah. We're a little embarrassed about the people that email and say, I can't open this. We say, well, neither can we, but we're not going to delete it. You know, maybe someone will write a reader in the future.
People ask us why we don't go only with PDF and stuff like that, and the reason is that people own, it's a proprietary format, and we want to make sure that all this stuff is going to be, he's dreaming shorter than I am. 50 years is nothing in my dreams. I'm thinking about how this is all going to look 1,000 years from now, you know, maybe 100,000 years from now. I just, like I said, though, if I get to a quadrillion books, I'm happy. Yeah?
I've downloaded a lot of your human read audiobooks and love them. And I just wonder, you want to talk at all about what you're doing in the way of audiobooks?
Human read audiobooks, yeah.
We're recruiting actors and people like that. We've hit up the Screen Actors Guild. There's a lot of out-of-work actors out there. and we're hitting them up. And we're also working on more and more different programs where the words have actually been read into the programs by humans, much like the old MIDI. I don't know if you remember the MIDI synthesizers that actually, some of them used synthetic tones, and some of them actually had people play the notes into them, and then it reproduced the note for you. We're working on every one of those aspects, and it's a little slower than I would like, but it's coming.
We have two really good partner sites on that. It's LibriVox and Literal Systems. I'd say LibriVox is probably out ahead a little bit, but if you go to gutenberg.org/audio, they'll link to those sites. And the human read audiobooks, I just put one on this because it's 250 megabytes. I put on the Sherlock Holmes, one of the Sherlock Holmes readings. It's wonderful. So mostly we're trying to work with projects that are more geared towards doing the things that are required for human read audiobooks, which involves some different things than doing the plain textbooks. And then we're starting to collect them. We have been collecting them. We're continuing to collect them into the Gutenberg collection. We got 50 or 75 human read. We got about 300 computer text-to-speech.
Hey, I wanted to ask if there's any scope within Project Gutenberg for not just expired copyrights and old things, but people who want to write something today and maybe contribute to Creative Commons or public domain.
We have several different ways to do that. And if the people that email us, we try to figure out what their goals are as to which one would work out best for them. We have a preprint site. We have approximately 2% of our stuff is still done copyrighted by permission of current authors. Some people keep the copyright and give us permission. Some people give us the copyrights. Some people put them in the public domain. There's a lot of different ways to solve that problem. But we're working on modern day stuff as well.
Yeah, the main impediment for some folks is what we mentioned before about PDF and stuff like that. So many people have formats that we're concerned about their longevity. And so what we usually do with those, as you mentioned, we don't put them into the main Gutenberg collection, but we have this preprint site. I'll try to get a web browser up, and you can see it. It's preprints.readingroo.ms, which is reading rooms, right? And we love to get stuff.
Yeah.
Back to the audiobooks for a sec. Does the copyright only, the copyright that you deal with, does it apply only to the work that's being read or the reading itself?
If you want to copyright your own reading of it, you can do that. It'll become your audio edition.
Okay.
And if you want to create your own paper edition, you can do that too. Now, United States law requires more intellectual input to get a copyright than other countries' laws. Some of them have what they call the sweat of the brow kind of stuff, and we don't have much of that. So you would have to do something rather unique, but a reading is very unique. So that would be very easy for you to copyright.
Okay, that's why I was wondering, because I have old taped or old vinyl recordings of audio productions that I know some of are out of...
Well, you want to check with a good copyright lawyer, because the law on all of that changed in 1972. If you have any recordings from 1972 and before, There's a very good chance that they don't get a copyright in it.
Okay.
But you do want to check it. I know 1,000 times more about copyright than I ever wanted to know, and I can't answer all of the questions anyway.
And if they're clear, I'm sure you'd accept them in like MP3, right?
Well, if you do your research, any of the formats.
Yeah. Okay.
If you do your research on this stuff and you come up with the reasonable decision that it's public domain, you're what they call an innocent infringer. They can sue you for $100 or $200 or something.
That's not bad.
But they can't take your house or anything because you did some research and you did enough to say, I think this is in the public domain.
Yeah.
But it helps to do some research, and we'll help you do it.
Yeah, that's what people got to understand. We, as Michael said, we're unwilling experts in copyright. And we have, if you go to Gutenberg.org, there's a how-to section. We have a copyright how-to. This is distillation of four or five very big lawyers, expert lawyers in copyright issues, and we keep patents and trademarks. That's a separate thing. But for copyright, we have a whole procedure to go through. And when we go through that procedure, when you go to the Gutenberg site and you let us do your copyright, well, you provide the information, then we make a determination of public domain status. We haven't been wrong yet. Basically, we've made a few things that are gray area. There are some things that are up in the air. Some of you might have heard about the orphaned works decisions. There's some stuff in Title 17, Section 108H that we're looking at. So there are some things that are gray, and we're actually trying to push those boundaries where we think that basically, it should basically fall to the people rather than falling to some long-dead author's estate or copyright.
Now, I'm also going to warn everybody. I am going to try to get in some more of what I want to talk about. No. I just don't want to get totally off. We're getting so far into copyright, and we could stay there forever, and that's good, but I want to get to the end and bounce back so you know what the options are. As soon as we know what the options are, then I'm willing to go for any of the options that are available.
So let's go. I'll get you back. I just want to show the screen print site.
Go ahead while he's playing with it.
Okay. You have a subset of books from Books for Free. A subset of the audio books.
Audiobooksforfree.org. That's a place that gave us some of our ebooks. They're not what we call a close affiliate. They're just some people that we worked with to get those particular items.
But you only have a subset of their books.
That's right. A subset of their books.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Audiobooks for Free is a site that's based in the UK. They do pretty professional readings as opposed to LibriVox, which sound very good, but they're really amateurs. And they do have not only further books, but they also have some higher, I don't know if they do stereo, but they have some higher quality, higher sound quality recordings.
No, I wanted to take like 5 or 10 minutes right now to just try to cover all the junk, at least for 1 second apiece, so that I want to at least throw out there, and then you guys can pick what you want to hear about. But each one of these inventions that I've been talking about changed the whole idea of civilization, changed what it was to be a member of a civilization, a member of society, changed the idea of how much you could know, how much you could look up, how much information you could have without somebody else telling it to you. We were always so dependent on somebody else telling us everything. And each one of these gave people an opportunity to have a truly encyclopedic set of knowledge in their own house. Now, when I was a kid, these things cost $1,500 for the great books of the Western world and the Britannica and the Americana and all those other things that I grew up with. Today, you know, I'm sure that somebody here has gone out and bought the Britannica for $15 on a DVD like I did, brand new. I couldn't tell you how many copies I have of the Britannica on DVD and CD, but I can tell you that I do have one for every 10 years for over a century in paper. These things are fantastic, and it's just going to keep going on that way unless they stop us. Right now, the concept of copyright has been determined by the U.S. Supreme Court as to be possibly permanent. How many of you heard of Eldred versus Ashcroft? Before it was Eldred versus Ashcroft, it was Hart, that's me, versus Reno. And I was suing on behalf of Project Gutenberg, but the lawyers were doing such a terrible job, I fired them. So I don't really, that's not a great story, but they came in, they were going to lose 5-4, they lost 7-2, all right? But now the Supreme Court's even worse, so I don't think there's any chance of getting the law changed unless there's somebody out there who's willing to be much more revolutionary than I am. Things are going to happen quite a bit differently. 100 years ago, over half of all copyrights had expired. And it was a very nice kind of ratio. New stuff was coming into publication about as fast as the old stuff was going out. Kind of nice. 100 years from now, 99.99, and I don't know how many more nines, of everything that was ever copyrighted will still be under copyright. If I wanted to bring a bunch of dishes and do a stack of dishes and show you with pie charts on the dishes, because if I took a couple stacks of dishes taller than I am, I could make the mark of how big a percentage in the year 2100 by taking a plate and drawing a little triangle in it about that wide on a dinner plate. That will be, I mean, if you take your kid to the new Lion King, take a 5-year-old kid to the new version of the Lion King this year, that kid will have to live to 2100 before that copyright would expire, even if it's never extended. Again, I don't want to go too far into that. That may not be what you guys want to hear about. But every one of these five information ages was countered by a copyright to stop the technology that could have given everybody basically all the information in the world. Right? This has happened before, and as I said, you're going to have somebody more revolutionary than I am. Okay. Now, why are they doing all that? They're setting up precedents. Our legal system is based on precedents. Now, I don't know how many of you guys have ever seen a replicator product in real life, but I brought some. Ever heard of the MIT Fab Lab? I gave a speech over there last week, and they were kind enough to make me some goodies to show you. This is a mounting bracket for a solenoid. In and of itself, it's not terribly cute, except for the fact that it was made by a 40,000-pound per square inch water drill. One of the cutest little gizmos I've ever seen. We made a bunch of these. This is really cute. And it's like I said, there's nothing special about it other than the fact that how it was made. Nobody ever touched it. You just threw this piece of metal in there, it goes, you know, got to have goggles on. This is a pulley. Goes on an axle, has a little notch to put the rope on, and you
ride the rope around it, and it was part of a triple set of pulleys, and they gave me one. This was cut out by a laser, and a laser that was finely tuned enough, I didn't even have to wear any laser-proof goggles. I got to watch it make this thing, and this is seriously hard. This is about 60 to 80% as hard as anything you could make the pulley out of. It's not rapid prototyping anymore. It's not just soft plastic. You can make real operational stuff ready to go. And this, of course, is a Starship. And this is ABS plastic. And there are half a dozen other materials you can make things out of that I've been fond of this whole idea for years and years and years. I started talking about faxing pizzas and doing stuff like that back in the early 90s. And I used to lose my audience when I talked about that stuff. They just, whoa, this guy's out to lunch and it's pizza from a fax machine. We got to shoot him. What was that?
That was the Starship build.
Oh, it's layer by layer. It's one of those where they run the layers. And this particular one, I didn't watch this particular one get made. The one I watched being made was made out of the old polymer stuff. So this is, if you can look this, I can send you the program for this, and I can send you a whole list of the composites it's made out of. So if you email me, I have it. In fact, I have it right around my neck. It's all right here. When I was walking through the Fab Lab, I stuck this into everything it was making it and downloaded the instructions. And I have permission from the MIT guys to put those three things on Project Gutenberg, so you will see them. You can download them and make your own, and then you can find out exactly how it's made. Okay, now, again, I want to leave as much time for you guys as possible. I designed a crayon jet printer years and years ago that you probably don't want to hear about because it's easy to think about. Imagine melting the little pieces of wax and firing them off, and you could build up a really great relief map of anything you wanted. I thought this was just totally cosmic until somebody printed me out a human hand, and you could almost read the fingerprints. The resolution was so good. I mean, you could take it to a palm reader, and they could read the palm. It's unbelievable stuff that you can make with these things. I do still lose people when I talk about driving away in a Ferrari that you print out on your computer, because you got to get oil in between the cylinders and everything, but I still say that you will be able to do it someday. Think about, I'm sure some of you, those guys were talking about the Cocos and all that, remember when there was only one color. It was a bit. It was either on or off. That was it. That was the number of colors you got. And now you can't get less than 16 million colors, and you can get a lot more. I say the same thing for these materials. All you have to do is double the number of materials every so often, and eventually you'll have all the materials you want. So don't want to get too tied up in that. But if you like that stuff, read Diamond Age. If you look at my pictures on the web where I'm up in a tree reading a book, this is what I'm reading. This is the only hardback book I ever bought new off the shelf when it was new in my life. And it was before I knew Neil. I actually went to a conference like this one, and I was standing in line with a couple of weirdos. We were having a great conversation. And make a long story short, we got to the end, and we put our badges on. And one of them was St. Jude, and the other one was Neil, and the other one was me. And I thought, wow. What a coincidence. It's like we put the badges on. Oh, you're you. Oh, you're you. We had been yakking up a storm in line for 45 minutes and had more fun than we had during the entire conference. Okay. Engines of Creation by Eric Drexler. It's not a novel, but I read it like one. I just ate the whole thing up. So you're interested in nanotech and replicators and all this stuff. I'm telling you, you can buy a 3D printer now for less than an IBM AT cost in 1984. I'm talking a full boat AT. Not even counting inflation. The same list price, not counting inflation. So you can build, I want people printing out Donatello's David and Michelangelo's David and the Venus de Milo and all that stuff, not just the Mona Lisa. Okay. Got to get to, oh, this is details we can get into later. I'm supposed to mention the World eBook Fair. I'm just going to have to go for it. I don't like blowing my own horn too much. But I asked a friend of mine to help me celebrate the 35th anniversary of me sitting down on the teletype and typing in the Declaration of Independence. So he gave me a quarter of a million books that I could give you, and they're all right there. If you go to worldebookfair.com for the next 2 weeks till August 4th, there's all the Project Gutenberg books, and there's a quarter of a million more, not counting for duplication. There's over 350,000, so we're saying we got a third of a million. And they're all free. You just search them out and download them and give those to your friends, too. I just wanted to get the maximum publicity for everybody, and this is a guy who sells these, and he's giving them away for free for a whole month just because I asked him. So, really nice. More junk. Oh, here's the traffic pattern. For some reason, nobody comes in on the weekend. So, if you get in there right now, you should be able to suck up lots of books. And it looks like a lot of our traffic's coming from Europe and Asia, much more than we expected. So, that's the traffic pattern at the World eBook Fair. Since the first couple of days where we had to switch servers and wires and do all sorts of other things because it was just getting overloaded to the max, we've given away over a million books a day, every day since about July 7th. So the 32 days we're going to have, I'm going to guess we're going to make it to 30 million books. But we also gave away 30 million books right here at this conference. Okay, we don't need to talk about that. We did that. This is how you can volunteer. The easiest way to volunteer is just send me an email. I love helping people volunteer. Got 50,000 volunteers, and they all say, "I'm so sorry to bother you." And I go, "That's what I'm here for. I'm here to help you guys figure out how to get started." More junk. All right. So now, officially, we got back to the end and the beginning. So now we can go to any one of those spots you want or other spots. I apologize, but I just wanted to make sure I got everything covered. Okay. Question?
Yes, I do have a quick question. Since you do kind of push these open formats, like, can you not hear me? Since you do kind of push these open formats, like raw text and stuff, have you had any blind, visually disabled people call you up and say, "Hey, thanks a lot, man"? Because traditionally they would have to find a book printed in Braille, and not everything gets made into Braille, right?
There it is. A month goes by that I don't get a note from some visually impaired person who says, "Please don't ever stop making plain text e-books." Now, I gotta straighten a couple things out. It's not that I'm against all these other formats. People have misquoted me because they wanted to fight for some other format and said, "Michael Hart wrote to kill Adobe." You know, I don't want to kill Adobe. I just want to have plain text too. I went to meet with the TEI guys back in the 90 or something like that, and they wanted to destroy plain text. There was a Library of Congress workshop on e-text in 1992 that never once mentioned plain text, and a great revenge I got because they published it in PDF format and wanted to get some feedback off the list servers, and nobody answered. And week after week after week, I got to tease them in front of 10,000 readers and say, "You know why they're not answering? Because they want it in plain text. They don't want to play with PDF." Now, this is 1992. It didn't come up automatically, okay? You had to fool around with it. They never got one message from one person until they put it out in plain text. So, Montezuma, I got my revenge.
And do you have a sense if they use more text-to-speech or more...
Oh, yes. They're much easier. Yeah, plain text works for everything.
Right.
Okay. Now, this XML kind of thing that Greg was talking about, you should be able to create plain text out of that. So I got nothing against being able to go this way and that way, as long as you can get back to something that the average person wants to use. Interview coming out in the IEEE magazine today, I think,
was really hard on me about that. And I said, the reason I do that is because I can stand here and say, I dare you, I double dog dare you to find one computer that won't read our books.
Yeah. 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 Let me mention about Braille also. The Blind Bookworm is one site where they have a lot of stuff about use. Converting to a Braille format with NFB trans is something that we're planning on offering. I've done that a little test basis, again, good opportunity. And but I really want to plug Aaron. Aaron is the guy that manages our CD-ROM giveaway project. He was the guy that burned 1,500 of these brand new ISOs, brand new DVDs from an ISO to give away. He's blind. He's a college student in, totally blind. He's a college student in Iowa. That's Aaron Cannon. So thanks to him.
Lots of help.
You know, e-books are fantastic for educating people around the world, but for poor areas of the world, the hardware to read e-books might not necessarily be as readily available. Things like the $100 laptop project certainly help that sort of thing. $50 laptop, probably better, but we'll get to 100 first. I'm just curious what your take is on the hardware with e-paper, e-ink solutions, things like that that are starting to come out now.
Well, I got two answers to that. One is, while I was at MIT, I just happened to meet with the $100 laptop guys, and we're going to do some kind of joint project with them. And my own, I like to work from the bottom up. I'm a simple guy when it comes to that stuff. All my stuff is from garage sales. Everything that you see, almost everything I own is from garage sales. And my solution to that particular question is cell phones. In the next 12 months, there are going to be 1 billion new cell phones in the world. And I'm pushing for a friend of mine named John Mietze from Malta, who has a little site up, mobile books and stuff like that. Email me and I'll tell you all about it, or go to our latest newsletters that I wrote a month ago, because I've been on the road a month. And you can download 5,000 of our books that have already been converted into a WAP-compatible cell phone. And we're going to put lots of other cell phone. The iPod was only out for a week before somebody wrote a program to read our stuff on the iPod. I'm waiting for somebody to read it out loud on the iPod. All sorts of things like that. So, yeah, cell phones. I got a message, a text message from a guy from his cell phone on the Serengeti plain in Africa who was reading one of our books in Urdu. And I thought, yes, that's the definite way for this to go. You guys are going to have to decide who was in line first. I'm sorry.
I think it was me. I thought I was. This is sort of a side note almost, but the idea of distributed proofreading, I heard also from the folks at E Pluribus Media, which I don't know if you guys know, but it's really a lot of fun. They're the folks who revealed that through distributed journalism research, they revealed that there was a guy who'd been allowed into the White House press corps who was not only a Republican plant blogger, but was also a male prostitute. So, you know, so they're also working. That's sort of a side note, but they also have distributed proofreaders and distributed fact checkers, and I'm wondering how long do you think that model is going to be viable? Because it's one of those things that just sort of, you know, takes a lot of time. It's a labor of love. How long will that go on?
I can't imagine it stopping for several reasons. The first reason, which was valid 20 years ago as it is today, is that you can take a diff program or a comp program and compare any of the files that different people proofread and see all the differences in 1 second. Somebody changed one comma in the thing, it's going to pop up. So, you know, we always had the issue way, way, way back when of 1984-ism. If you'll notice, the first books I did, there are like 20 or 30 versions of Alice in Wonderland. Literally, there's all the way up to Alice30.htm and stuff. Because every time I changed it, I put a new file up so you could see the whole evolution from the first one and how we got rid of the errors little by little. Now, distributed proofreaders, for those who don't know, is a setup where you can come in and proofread one page while you're waiting for somebody to come pick you up. You can just log in and grab a page. You can grab another page. You can just sit there and grab a page as often as you want. You can claim a whole book if you want. But a lot of people just pop in here and there. There are single, we had a big rush one weekend, I think, where there were like 12,000 people proofreading in one weekend.
It just gets absolutely berserk as to how many pages you can get done. And we have every one of them done twice, by the way. Yeah. We have done copyright research and all sorts of other things for anybody who was interested in ebooks ever since I started. I just want to promote ebooks. You notice in our mission statement, it didn't say public domain ebooks or nonprofit ebooks or anything like that. It says, my job is to promote the creation and distribution of ebooks, period. Everybody who started in the ebook business way back when called me. And I helped them to the best of my ability. That's the way it goes.
Distributed Proofreaders is an organization that's a extremely close affiliate. You know, we buy their hardware. We have really tight ties, but they make their own decisions also about what to process. And they do focus a lot on the public domain, and that's great. We encourage people, and they'll help to set up additional distributed proofreaders. So we have one site that's up and running pretty successfully, DP of Europe, and we'd love to set up other sites. So if people have particular areas that they're interested in, then you can work with the DP folks to get the code.
Yeah, so access to manuscripts and papers is a big deal in scientific publishing, and I don't know if you guys have had any connections with people at the Public Library of Science, plos.org?
A little bit.
Okay.
We've swapped emails with them. Sometimes people like that ask us to make a backup for them, and sometimes they want us to keep it private because they want to get all the hits. Again, we don't care who gets the hits. We help in any way that we can for them, and if you know somebody there and you think you can make a connection for us, we'd love to do it.
No, I do, but I just mentioned it because it takes the same issue of opening up copyrights and access to scientific literature. And so my question is about scientists and just any reader in general. People build up their own libraries over the course of their lifetime, and yet I want my library to be accessible by anybody, my personal library. And I think if somebody wants to share their library with me, I should have access to that. So to what extent have you thought about developing models or standards for making real distributable libraries or making your library accessible to you and everybody else from anywhere?
Okay, I think that I'm going to answer your question, I hope, but it's something that I already thought of, and not specifically in response to your question, so I may not hit the nail on the head. I call the philosophy that I work with unlimited distribution. The idea basically is that once Project Gutenberg puts an ebook online, every BBS and every guy with a Coco and anything else out there who wants to put that book on their little system is just dandy with me. Linus Pauling, Linus Torvalds said, real men don't use backup, or only wimps use backups. Real men put their stuff on FTP and let the whole world download it. He had exactly the same thing, same idea I did. I just was trying to do it with more stuff. In fact, I got a little story that may be worth telling about that, where I pulled an all-nighter. I mean, a literal all-nighter. One of those things where you're just wasted and you fall into the sack and you don't even think about which side you're going to sleep on. And I did three books that night from end to end. And when I put them in two copies on the East Coast, two copies on the West Coast, and two copies in the Midwest, and I went to sleep. And when I woke up, they were all gone. And I was just totally freaked because I knew it would be a week before I had enough energy to do that again. And then I got the wise idea, after pounding my head against the wall for a while, of sending out an email to 100 of my favorite friends and say, did anybody download these before they disappeared? Yes. I was saved because all our stuff goes up immediately and people have little clocks set all day long for people to back up our system. They're rsyncing every minute of every day. So it's now hard for us to lose a book. And the whole idea is based on the fact that we put a book up. For example, I did an Icelandic book called Cormac the Skald. And there's only one copy of it in existence that's known, and I didn't know that. I didn't know we got a hold of the only copy. Somebody just sent it to me and said, here. And I put it up there, and I woke up in the morning, and I thought, I didn't do enough copyright research on this book, even though it's like from 1100 or something like that. And, I'm going to wake up, and I'm going to see if somebody claimed a copyright or this, that, or the other. So I logged in, and I did a search. and I got one hit. I thought, great, I'll find it. It was us. We were already listed in the OCLC catalog. So by the time I fell asleep to the time I woke up to check the book, we're now the authority on this book. So it's really strange. I mean, we're listed.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
We all, in the same time, I found out we were listed as having the best Robert Louis Stevenson collection in the world and stuff like that. Just every once in a while, I turn around and find the weirdest dang reference to Project Gutenberg that nobody told me. They don't call me up and interview me before they write these articles half the time. And then somebody says, did you know? And I go, no. And I knew we did a lot of Robert Louis Stevenson. I didn't know we were the best. Okay, anyway.
Part of the question was about building personal bookshelves and stuff like that.
Well, that can be distributed. I mean, we all curate libraries, and curation of your technical papers and all that is a big deal, and you should benefit.
You thinking P2P?
Yeah. No, he's thinking of personal bookshelves. So we haven't done a lot of that on the main Gutenberg server, because mostly what we say is, look, we're really good at creating books, getting them out there, storing them, providing some basic cataloging information. We want other folks to provide all these ways of reaching in that we didn't yet dream up. I'm going to show you one right here, invite you to make others, and mention that we also, in a related thing, we work with Wikipedia. So right now we were talking about, hey, let's do author bios, let's do bibliographies, let's do about this book. And then we said, wait a minute, we're not really set up for that. We're set up for like these big files that don't change all that often. And we started working with Wikipedia, so now we link to them. And we let them do that. So that's one two directions. The other up on the screen, I apologize for Michael's choice of colors here. These are really weird colors. But snowy.arsc.alaska.edu/pgiso. That's where I made this image, although I had to tweak it a whole lot afterwards. People make their own collections of our ebooks, and there's not a ton here because there's not a ton of people that have seen this yet. But they create their own collections. Right, so you select some of our stuff and you publish it, and then someone that says, hey, I'd like to get some of that stuff, you click over here and you say, make me an ISO, and it makes you an ISO and emails you when it's done. So those are a couple of things that we're doing, but I think the larger question to your answer is, we don't want to do all that stuff. We want to try to focus on what we're good at, and we say yes. We always encourage people to do stuff, and then of course people discover, oh, well, now I got to work.
And we also got a 15-minute warning, so if everybody asks a question and it only takes 3 minutes, we're going to run out of time.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Hi. I'd just like to say thanks because this project is amazing and great. But also, my question is about the text formatting. I know you mentioned that. I mean, I completely agree with the plain text formatting and how it's essential. And you said you were doing a little HTML to make it a little more readable. And I'm wondering if you've experimented with things that are more for like printed page like tech or something like that, which is plain text, but has a little more facility for page formatting and is a lot easier to read the actual markup than HTML is because of all the closed tags and things.
You're
like
talking
that?
To the wrong guy.
Yeah. Okay. The answer is yes. Yeah, okay. We'd love it. We have plenty of tech books. We have not. I shouldn't say plenty. We have more HTML and stuff like that. But especially for mathematical text, tech is the answer. We were really interested, by the way, this Newton's Principia. We really want to get Newton's Principia online, and it's a bear. It's a monster. But you're not going to do that in anything but tech, probably LaTeX, probably these days.
So what's the reasoning for the choice of HTML?
We don't choose. We encourage, we enable, we accept.
The book the way they want to make it.
Yeah, we answer yes. Now, the HTML is because, hey, there's a lot of great tools for HTML. They're accessible, all that stuff. Yeah. And so that's what we get. When we change to XML, we'll have more options for spreading into further formats. But tech is an option, and maybe there'll be some future stuff that's okay as well. We got 20, 30 something different formats, including NFO. We're not doing any more NFOs, okay? No more of those folio, but almost any other reasonable format.
We have .lit.
Yeah, we got with the POM and all that stuff.
Okay, again, thank you. It's one of my most excited projects.
Thanks. Nice. Well, listen, someone asked a question about mirroring. Let me just answer really quickly. There's a mirror how-to. Okay, it's about 160 gigabytes right now. We do a lot of rsync. And the ReadingRoo server, which is running this World eBook Fair, has been pushing 60 to 100 megabits for 2 weeks and has been doing great. But by and large, getting your own copy of the collection on your own server that you can use for your purposes, your friends, or whatever, pretty easy. See the mirroring how-to. Got a question about that.
And if you leave out the human genome, it gets easier.
My question is about whether Project Gutenberg is interested in craft instructional materials. There's a lot of orphaned books and magazines and pamphlets from the first half of the 20th century that are really just being lost because the publishers don't exist anymore. The yarn companies that originally published them aren't, you know, they have never renewed their copyrights. And then within the craft community, there are people who say, oh, but everything's copyrighted, and so you can't circulate that. Yeah. Would Project Gutenberg be interested in things like knitting and instructional materials?
We'll help. The thing when people say that we think this is copyrighted, whatever is copyrighted, as I said, unfortunately, we're experts. And usually send an email to copyright@pglaf.org. I get that, and we'll try to help out. Again, a little related to the other question we got, sometimes formatting can be a real issue. You know, we don't really want to have a TIFF and just a TIFF or something like that. You know, we really want to actually turn it into an ebook that you can use for all these other purposes. You know, derivative works, cutting and pasting, sharing with a bunch of your friends, printing, you know, if you want to. That's, by the way, what we didn't mention. That's one of the things that we really think distinguishes Gutenberg from some of the work we hear coming out of, your Googles and Yahoos and so forth. They're mostly doing pictures of books with raw OCR. We feel like you need a little more push. Unfortunately, that little more push is a lot of work to get it to where we really want to be with being a usable ebook. It's a longer answer than you bargained for. Short answer is yeah. That would
be great. A picture of a book is not a book. If I have a Ferrari, I want to drive away in it. If I have a pipe, there's a famous painting of a pipe that says this is not a pipe under it. And when people ask me why isn't a Google book a book, it's because you can't search it. You can't, you know. But the most important thing is, you can read it. And that is definitely the most important part. But it's not an e-book. It's a Google book. Project Gutenberg.
Hi. I want to thank you guys for all your good work, and I have a copyright question for you. I think we all agree that all Earthlings should have access to every book, but we have to overthrow U.S. copyright laws if we want to make that happen. But is there another country that we could work in?
Iraq has very limited... We understand they haven't yet signed the Berne Convention. Turns out Afghanistan is the other one that never signed the Berne Convention. I don't know if that's related or not. But copyright has been extended in the European Union, as a lot of you know, to 70-plus. Australia just did 70-plus years. Most of the rest of the world is life plus some number. U.S. is a fixed amount. Again, short answer is there's not a whole lot out there. And if you want to think in terms of data repository types of things, you know, a lot of you know about Haven Co. and you've read the Neal Stephenson book that talks about that. The problem is that if I'm in the U.S., I'm the infringer in the U.S., regardless of whether the data live, you know, on Sea Island or something.
And I talked to
like
the
that.
Haven Co. guy, and he didn't want to have anything to do with it.
Yeah, their bandwidth was a little too expensive for us, actually. Yeah, but anyway, so unfortunately, it's not that good an opportunity. We tend to be really, really cautious, as I said. We have collaborators. The Project Gutenberg Consortia Center, who's running this World eBook Fair, most of it anyway, is slightly less sort of paranoid than we are. And there are plenty of other people that say, hey, it looks public domain, smells public domain, no one's complained, and we'll put it up for download. But that doesn't get us the contemporary stuff that's kind of perpetually under copyright. It doesn't look that good for the rest of the world.
But we are doing more and more contemporary stuff, and there's a lot of contemporary stuff at the World eBook Fair right now. If you want to see stuff that was just printed in the last couple of years, get on there and go to some of the sponsor sites. Sadly to say, Jim Bain died while I was on my trip.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I wanted to meet him in New York. He's one of the sponsors of the World eBook Fair, and he gave us a heap of books that we can all give away to you guys. And we're going to have – there's stuff I can't say because people have maybe promised not to. All I can say is we're going to have a lot more books.
Thanks.
As you amass a huge amount of material – what sort of solution do you have for indexing it, for finding any particular thing if you don't know exactly what you're looking for?
Well, if you go on to the Project Gutenberg Consortia Center site, that site has been totally crawled word by word, and you can search any phrase and find it in any one of the books any way you like. It takes for freaking ever
to run that search. And we actually bought new UPSs because the searches were taking 2 or 3 weeks, and the thing would crash sometime during the 2 weeks, so we just didn't get it done.
The indexing would take two or three
weeks. To make the index.
Searching is a little faster than that. Indexing takes 2 or 3 weeks.
Oh, yeah. No, our search takes longer than your search. Yeah. To build the index that you guys get to search like that takes 2 or 3 weeks. And finally what we did was we farmed it out to somebody else. It just got to be too much of a pain.
We should plug them, actually. It's coop.org, and they've been running – so readingroo.ms has been pushing, as I said, up to 100 megabits for the last couple of weeks. They've been serving we don't know how many queries, millions of queries, and we crashed them. They rebuilt. They grew.
They rewrote the program for us.
Yeah. But they're actually pretty hot. Google, of course, indexes the main Gutenberg collection. We have a search for them. Yahoo has us in a special program where you can do like author title searches. So we also have cataloging for our books. So we try. We're not professional catalogers, and as I said, we try to leave some of this stuff to people that know it better than we do. But we try to do a little bit of everything. The other thing we have is an RDF XML file that you can download and build your own catalog using our data as input. And all the stuff, the few things I just mentioned, are on the advanced offline catalog page at Gutenberg.org.
The $100 laptop people made big noises about rebuilding our catalog for us, too. But they haven't answered my email since I left MIT, so...
They don't know. One thing, people don't realize how big this is. So, you know, 250,000 files. Yeah, you know, you got 250,000 files. But, 20,000 titles can be an awful lot. There are issues with character sets, languages, having author names that don't quite match. And we fix these as we get errors. But we really I want to encourage people to do probably a better job than we do of the basically the cataloging type of stuff, finding aids type of things.
Thank you very much.
Michael, you started a thought that I'm not sure you finished, and I want to see if I can get you to finish it.
I never finish anything.
You were talking about copyright, stopping the information waves.
Yeah.
And then you said, why are they doing this? They're setting precedent. And then you started talking about the Neil Stephenson stuff, and I never... What precedents are they setting?
Okay. Have you read Diamond Age?
Yes.
Okay. I strongly suggest... Everybody here read Diamond Age. Anybody who doesn't like it, swear to God, send it to me or give it to me or whatever. I will pay you at least half of what you paid for it, and I'll give it to somebody else. That's as good, I mean, this is hundreds of people, but I will do it because I could never get enough copies of it anyway. Same with Dandelion Wine, by the way. Okay, now, the reason I recommend talking about Diamond Age, now, you may want to plug your ears or something. I want to mention a couple things, and I hate, or maybe I should do this by email.
It's a spoiler warning.
Yeah, this is a definite spoiler warning. But I'm going to ask it as questions. I'm going to do Socratic method here rather than tell you the answers. So the real question is, why does it start with Bud? Of all the creepy lowlifes in the world, why does it start with Bud? When you can answer that question, you'll understand a heap more about Diamond Age and a heap more about what I was talking about, in the sense that every time that people, the masses, can have stuff, the haves versus the have-nots want to step in and make sure they can't have it. Now, I can go into, you want to look up the history of fashion, particularly Italian fashion. There were laws about how long your freaking toes on your shoes could be. So that if you had toe, that's why, by the way, that's why Italian shoes have pointy toes. Because it was against the law, if you were one of us, to wear the pointy toes. It was actually against the law to wear those kinds of clothes. Now, Star Trek, anybody watch Star Trek? My favorite quote, well, I'm not a real Trekker or Trekkie, but there's some seriously good stuff in there now and then. And my favorite quote is in one where Worf and Data find these frozen people. One of them's a folk singer, one of them's a zillionaire, and one of them's just somebody. And the folk singer says, I got a whole new audience. I can go out there and do all this stuff. And the lady wants to find her relatives. And the zillionaire says, freaking Picard, I could buy this ship several times over. And long story short, gets to the end, and Picard finally tells him, very gently, that there's no such thing as money. And the guy's about ready to freak out.
Well, what do you invest in? And Picard says, we invest in ourselves. We live in a society where we are defining ourselves by our possessions. As long as we define ourselves by our possessions, having the distinction between the haves and the have-nots will be the most important thing. And that philosophy has governed all of our civilizations all the way back to the amoeba. The amoeba says, it's better if I have it and you don't. That's the way it goes. Now, up until electronic books, there was only one thing in the whole world that all of you could have as much as you wanted of. What was it?
Air.
Very good. Air. Today, you can buy any computer off the shelf and download a million copies of that Declaration of Independence I typed in, and you won't even notice it put a dent in your hard drive. Right? You can have as many of those things as you want. The first thing besides air that you can have as much as you want of. I bought a terabyte, half a terabyte drive a couple weeks ago for $200. A week later, it was $10 cheaper. You know, you're getting to the point where you can hold in one hand, and this is some what I said the day that I started the e-books, the day I started Project Gutenberg, which technically, by the way, was July 5th. It was after midnight. I talked about laptops, and I talked about that you'd be able to carry the entire Library of Congress in one hand. And I immediately appended to that, and they will make a law against it. No, I wasn't as smart as it sounds. I wasn't. You read a lot of the stuff that I wrote back then, and I look at it and says, God, it sounds like I knew so much more than I really knew. I was just on the right trail. I didn't understand what I was doing. I just knew it was the right thing to do. Project Gutenberg is as much of a right brain thing as a left brain thing for me. You gotta remember, I'm the seat of the pants guy. I can't read a circuit diagram because I'm dyslexic. They don't make any sense to me. I can't read code. I can't even read a grep. It's too crazy for me. It makes me dizzy to look at a regular expression. But I do run command lines. I'm a command line guy rather than a point and click. I don't understand why this all works out the way it does. And we're running out of time, and I've said some really good things here. It would be a great place to end, but we always got room for one more question.
The question is, what is the website or websites that we should be going to?
Gutenberg.org, Gutenberg.cc. There's a Gutenberg.co.au or something like that. I'll email you all the sites.
Start at Gutenberg.org. That's a good place to go. That's with not the the occasional German way with two T's. It's...
Thank you.
Gutenberg.org.
Now, email me anytime, and I'll send you a whole list of the sites and even about how much is on each site.
There's a contact page there that lists both of our emails, and there's a help address, also goes to me, copyright address, also goes to me, and we'd be happy to talk to you.
There's 50 languages at Gutenberg.org. There's over 100 at Gutenberg.cc. So those are the biggies. You download everything from those two, you got a major whopping collection. But don't forget the Australians. They're coming. They're almost up to 1,000. And Project Gutenberg of Europe started a couple years ago, and they've got over 300. We've got Project Gutenberg in Portugal. Okay, go ahead.
Semi-rhetorical question. Diamond Age, when I walked into my favorite professor's department or office in my department for the first time, I noticed there was a copy of it on his shelf. The book is sort of a major touchstone. So my question is, when and where is the first conference that centers on the Diamond Age?
Well, I know the guy who runs DiamondAge.org.
Really?
So if you email me, I'll ask him for you.
Okay.
He's a replicator guy, by the way, just in case you didn't think that already. But I am so far into this replicator thing. To me, the replicators are magic. They're as far out there as my quintillion books. What about the primer?
The primer, yeah. Ladies, young ladies, primer.
Well, again, it's there's a right-brained aspect and there's a left-brained aspect. The young lady's primer is the right-brained aspect, and the whole programming thing, you know, where she starts playing with the chains and doing all that stuff, that's the left-brained aspect. And now there's another spoiler, all right? The end of the book.
Think about what happens at the end. I'm not going to say it, but what does she become? What's the result of what she does? You know, she basically creates her own civilization. All right? So you start with Bud. You end up with this new file. That won't mean anything to people who haven't read it. And that's kind of what I'm trying to do here, is I want to turn the original logo for Project Gutenberg was a big, long lever, huge lever, with the moon as the fulcrum, the Earth on the short end, and this little bitty guy stacking books on the long end, and little wiggle marks. And it said underneath, dragging the world kicking and screaming into the third millennium. That's where we started. Anybody ever heard of cow tipping? I'm into world tipping. I want to sneak up on the world while it's not looking.
I think we're done. Meet people in the back.
So we're gonna wrap up.
Yeah, I'll be more than happy to talk to anybody who wants to talk until I run out of gas. And if you feed me, that'll be a long time.
We're gonna shuttle right to Pentop North, and there are a bunch more DVDs. If you didn't get